Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I have my plus one plunger. I have my cup of coffee. Holy water. And two very special guests and union members with me today to help plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. Our guests today are straight out of Calgary, Alberta, and the creator of a variety of sci-fi and fantasy supplements. Welcome to the show, Terry and John from Terry Hurt Games.
Great to be here.
Wow, you guys are like super in sync. This is awesome. So super happy to have you guys on the show, fellow Canadians. Elbows up, as I like to say.
Right.
And ostensibly, we're here today to talk about your upcoming Kickstarter for Stargazer Keep, a cosmic sword and sorcery RPG zine series inspired by the music of Ronnie James Dio. But before we get there, let's just get to know you guys. Get a sense of who is Terry and John and what is Terry Hurt Games all about. So maybe if you want to start, Terry, since I feel like your name is on the label, maybe sure. Just hit us up with the where did this all begin?
Yeah. So Terry Hurt Games started, you know, probably about 10 years ago now. And I read a blog post from Alpha Stream. At the time, he was publishing stuff in the DMs Guild. And he wrote a blog post. It was called "What is an Adventure Worth?" And I read it, and it was a bit of a sobering view of the RPG community and, like, you know, what you could actually make for money. And I thought, well, gosh, you know what? I'd love to give it a go. I was kind of inspired. And so I started publishing material on the DMs Guild. And then as time went on, I thought I'd really like to, you know, make some larger projects. And I met my good friend John here. We met through kind of a mutual friend playing some games. And we decided we were going to do a Kickstarter together. And so we did a collection of small 5e adventures. And then flash forward a few years, you know, I've been putting out some material for Mothership and some other fantasy stuff. And now John and I are working on, I think, you know, John, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is kind of like a lifelong passion project for you, Stargazer Keep.
Yeah, it's been cooking for a while.
Nice. So how about you, John? What's your... How do you fit into this? Like, were you guys gaming buddies and then you came together like this, or?
Yeah, we had been playing games together for probably a couple years. And then Terry reached out to me and said, hey, do you want to, you know, jam and work together on something, see what we could come up with for a Kickstarter. I think it was your first Kickstarter, wasn't it, Terry?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, so kind of an experiment for both of us. I had never published anything or really written anything that it had ever intended to be shared with the public. I'd done a lot of homebrew and long time DMing and world building and stuff like that. So yeah, we just put together this little book of adventures. I think we both had a pretty good time communicating and world building and figuring all that stuff out together, but life got in the way, and so I had to step away from the creative side of things for a little while. But then as my family started to, you know, become a little more developed, I just had the itch, you know, to put something else out. And this idea for Stargazer Keep has been something that I have had in pretty much every campaign I've ever run in one form or another. And having a lot of time, you know, alone in the middle of the night, feeding a baby gives you a lot of time to think. And just like, I had to get those ideas out there. So reached out to Terry and said, hey, what do you think about this? And yeah, we came together again and started plugging away at this thing. It's been a couple years now that we've been working on it and getting close. We're getting close to the finish line.
Interesting. So what was your... Terry, where did you begin your like gaming career? Like,
it started in the high school cafeteria when you know, the other folks in band class said they wanted to play a game of riffs, and so I played old school D100 riffs with the classic Palladium books. I seemed to recall playing some sort of, I don't know, super overpowered character as they usually are. Instant hook. You know, me and that group, we became super close for many years. We played Dungeons and Dragons 3rd edition, then 3rd and a half, or 3.5 rather. We skipped 4th, like I think a lot of people did. And then I wound up delving into Pathfinder. And I think actually, John, I don't know if we were playing that when we met first here in Calgary, but I ran a lot of Pathfinder.
We were playing 5th edition, but it was in the Pathfinder setting.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, I did a lot of D&D, especially 5e for a while when I was publishing a lot of material for it. And then I started to really get on the Kickstarter craze. I have a big wall of books. You know, Jason, I see you got a big one too, right? So,
yeah.
And I wanted to play different games. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I picked up Morkborg and, you know, this is new, this is refreshing, and started doing some games for that and a little bit of, you know, adventure writing for that. And yeah, that's kind of where I've been at lately. I've been doing a big science fiction tear too. You know, Mothership is one of the Kickstarters that I backed that I really wanted to get out the table immediately. And I've run quite a few campaigns of that, lots of one shots, but we did some kind of like dungeon delve type games in that system. It was a lot of fun.
Nice. How about you, John?
So I guess I probably came to the hobby a little bit later than you did, Terry. Although I spent a lot of time in high school thinking about playing Dungeons and Dragons. Just like nobody that I knew was into it. A lot of my friends too would talk about it in the same way, like, oh yeah, wouldn't it be cool if we played D&D, but nobody had the initiative to pick it up and say, I'm going to DM. And so that went on for, you know, a few years. And then in my 20s, I finally found a DM who would run a game for me and my friends. And we played one session, and that was a 4th edition. And just never did it again. And then I was hooked, right? Like, so, that was right around the time that 5e came out. So I picked up the books and just said, okay, I'll do it. I'll be the one to, take on this burden. And realized very quickly that like it's, far more intimidating than it needs to be. You know, anybody can DM as long as they have the motivation to do it. So yeah, that kind of started you know, years long obsession now with tabletop role playing games. Moved on from D&D to like Powered by the Apocalypse, and then moved on from there to Blades of the Dark, which has been a big favorite of mine for many, many years. And then started to get more interest in Rules Light systems as I got older. And Morkborg being a perfect example of that. Found myself looking to create a mega dungeon, and based on a, you know, the writing, the lyrics of a heavy metal singer, and Morkborg seemed to fit pretty much perfectly.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking about that when you look at like the black metal of like kind of Morkborg, and then you mix it with Dio, you're kind of like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, especially like music in general seems to really be kind of like an important aspect of mm-hmm. like the Morkborg. I'm not really sure how you're supposed to say it. I've heard people say it that, like, this is the pronunciation of the game, but I'm like, I know it's got those little like dots little on dots. Top which have like a name for them, but you know, I'm ignorant and uneducated, so I don't know what they're called.
You know what? I'm gonna go with Morkborg, man. If I tried to say everything correctly, it would be difficult.
I think this is the reason why Free League won't have me on to like interview anybody. They're like, dude, when you learn how to pronounce Morkborg, then we can maybe talk. So I'm curious, like, how does it work with you two collaborating on the products that you've been working on? Because I imagine that it's got to be a difficult thing sometimes when you've got two people, two different ideas about things. And so how do you guys work together and put out a product?
Well, honestly, like maybe this is a big surprise, but I love working with you. I mean, you know, John and I, we yes and each other all the time. Like I wouldn't say we've never had a bad idea, but we've never like gotten stuck, you know, where it's like we have an interesting thought and suddenly it's evolving and we have like new layers to it. And this whole mega dungeon idea sort of started with, you know, John's original idea of the tower. And I think just by like bouncing ideas back and forth, suddenly it's like going straight up into the cosmos, you know. I just, yeah, it's awesome. I, you know, it, and not everyone works well together, but I feel like John, I feel like we work really well together.
Yeah, definitely. We've made some magic for sure. There was a moment early on in developing Stargazer Keep that I always think back on, and it was like we were both in Discord chatting with each other. We both had the Google Doc open, and you were writing parts of one set of rooms, and I was writing parts of another set of rooms, and I was seeing what you were writing, and I was like, oh, that's super cool. I'm going to incorporate it into this section, and we were kind of going back and forth like that. And yeah, I don't think we've ever really like clashed, and it's always just flowed pretty seamlessly, which, I mean, knock on wood, but it's
totally well. I mean, I don't know. The different creative ideas from another person is so valuable, because like sometimes when I write by myself, like I get stuck and like I don't know what to do, or I don't know what to come up with. And, you know, being able to ask you for things, or like, what do you think of this? Or sometimes you just swoop in with something that's even better. And it's like, well, obviously we'll do that instead.
So what is your like creative processes for the two of you? Like, starting with you, Terry, like, do you have like a time that you sit down and write, or how does it work for you?
It's definitely hard. Everyone, you know, it's hard for everyone to find a time that works for them and a time that's available. For me, I find I'm most creative in the mornings. And so I tend to go to bed quite early, and then I wake up and I do some writing before I do my normal day. I kind of work like a eight to five type job. So I try to write between, you know, 6 and 7:30 in the morning, if I'm able to. And then I tend to do like weekend mornings, and I do a lot of thinking when I walk. I like to go for like, you know, evening walks and like on Saturdays and stuff like that. And sometimes you got to let the ideas stew a little bit, you know?
How about you, John? What's your process like?
It's a little more chaotic. I have a notes app on my phone that's just a disaster of ideas. It's just like every time I have a half of a thought, it goes in there. And then I try to compile those when I have some free time. There's not a lot of unused ideas, but there are some, but a lot of times they end up getting recycled into something. And then I whenever I can, really, whenever I have some free time to sit down and develop those ideas and work on them. Usually, you know, having kids, it's whenever they're both sleeping, which tends to be rare, because they're, you know, much different ages. It ends up being a lot of times a much later night than I intended, because I'll sit down and then I'll just be spitting stuff out and forget to go to bed or forget to eat or whatever. Or it'll be early morning, waking up with the baby. When the baby's finally asleep, then I sit down for a couple hours and get some work done.
And you guys had mentioned that you were using like Google Docs to work together. When you go to do the actual like layout and get everything ready, do you have another, like, do you guys use Affinity or something like that as your, that you use for publishing?
Yeah, actually for this project, I've been teaching myself how to use Affinity, which has been probably one of the reasons why we've been at it for 2 years. It might've gone a lot faster if we had hired a layout artist.
You can't rush art, man. Like,
especially when you don't know what you're doing. There's been a lot of times where I've spent hours doing something and then I've, you know, taken a look at the toolbar and say, hey, what's that button do? And see that it's like, oh, I could have done that a lot faster and easier. It's been a rewarding experience. I don't know if I'll commit to doing layout in this capacity again. You know, three books is a pretty big task.
Okay. So what would your advice be to somebody who wants to like get into publishing, self-publishing and doing the layout and learning Affinity? Like, what kind of lessons have you learned that you'd be like, whatever you do, don't do this?
Keep it simple. Part of developing something that's compatible with Morkborg, you want to try to go crazy. Like, the Morkborg layout and design is like pretty wild. And I think a lot of people think they can just, you know, turn a black letter font on an axis and, make it fill up half the page and then it's good to go. But I think there's a lot more thought behind it in the actual core Morkborg book. Those guys are really talented at what they do. A hack like me starting to do that, I started to put something like that together and say, like, you know what, it's not really the same. It's not capturing the same magic that Morkborg does. So I found myself taking these wild swings and then taking it back quite a bit and trying to do something a lot simpler. And that's probably where most people should start, is just with a simpler design, a simpler layout.
I mean, I feel like that makes a lot of sense, but not only that, I think Morkborg is a beautiful book. It's like you said, there is something to the like chaos that makes it really special. And it's not just like there is an organization to it where you're like, wow, this is what makes it special. You can't really see it, but it's there. But like, for instance, like Pirate Borg, I don't know if you guys have seen Pirate Borg, but I feel like they went with a much simpler, more easy to read, kind of less chaotic layout. I almost feel like, not that I want to diss Morkborg, but I feel like that is the more usable format when you're at the table. I don't know how you guys feel about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of where I ended up with the design, was saying like, okay, let's think about usability first. Actually, one of my bigger touchstones with Death in Space, which is not Morkborg compatible, but it's Morkborg adjacent, and it is a very basic layout, very simplistic, minimal art, really easy to flip through, and more text on the page a lot of times, where Morkborg is a lot of more art on the page. And yeah, so it's been interesting to kind of try to strike a balance and to make something that's unique, that has our own stamp on it. So it's not just a clone. Because a lot of those more board compatible products kind of do come off looking like just a copy.
Yeah. We were really going for like a Morkborg light layout, because to your point, it was like too chaotic. Like sometimes it's difficult to see like what's actually going on the page. And we referenced the, I'm probably going to say this wrong, but the Feratory book, which was a little, you know, less in that direction. And we had some particular pages that we could kind of treat as touchstones. And like, you know, we've kind of taken it in our own direction, but we didn't want to overwhelm the reader, but we still wanted to express that like power metal vibe.
Right. Okay. So one of the things, like, I do want to get into the Stargazer Keep because clearly that's why we're here, but I was really fascinated when I saw the mothership that you guys worked on a bunch of mothership stuff. What was that experience like? And what was, because I almost got the impression, like, I could see that there was, from just from your drive through page, there was a lot of like, it looked like you early on, you started off with a lot of fantasy stuff, mm-hmm. and then you slowly sort of evolved into the sci-fi aspect. Is that like where your true love sort of lies, or am I just reading into this too deeply? I mean,
no, you can't read too deeply into this. Early love infatuation with both science and fantasy fiction, but I think science fiction has always been my true home. And I really had not found a sci-fi RPG that really like worked well at the table. Like I played a bunch of different ones over the years. I did a bit of Traveler, and it was maybe a little too mechanically. It was, you know, it's very crunchy. Like Traveler is a very crunchy game. And when Mothership came out, it just felt like it struck a chord. You know, I huge Alien fan. You know, it's basically a straight lift from from Alien. And it just, I don't know, it was easy to run. It was fun. There was a group of folks that were starting like a creator Discord. So I jumped in there and I just kind of surrounded myself with cool people. The science fiction genre is interesting to me because fantasy is always sort of static. It's always the same, like, you know, in terms of like time period. Science fiction feels like a moving target because, like, in the real world, technology is always like advancing. But the mothership feels like it's sort of frozen in time because it's really that, like, you know, capitalist hellscape. It's like I'm trying to make a living in a world where, you know, you don't own anything and nobody's happy. And so just that you know, what's the company in Alien? I'm gonna Weyland-Yutani. Yeah, not the snake people. Weyland-Yutani.
I mean, pretty close.
Could be an adventure idea there. Who knows? but at any rate, yeah, there's just like there's so much to go into in like that 80s sci-fi, and it's just a joy to play. It's a joy to write for, and really had a lot of fun doing that. And then I think, you know, when John pitched this idea for Stargazer Keep, that it would have sort of a cosmic influence, it's like, okay, you know what? Like, I can have peanut butter in my chocolate and do a little bit of both.
Interesting. How about you, John? Are you more on the sci-fi side or more on the fantasy side? Or you got to pick one, man. You can't be on the fence.
Oh, man. Well, you know what? If with a gun to my head, I would probably have to say fantasy. Although I feel more comfortable writing, I said that backwards. I'd have to say sci-fi. I feel more comfortable writing fantasy. I'm not sure why that is, but, I definitely, have always been, you know, sci-fi novels, you know, much more over fantasy novels. Yeah, like Terry mentioned, Alien, the Alien franchise is one of my absolute favorites. Mothership, one of my favorite games, super fun to play. And when it comes to Stargazer Keep, we kind of have the cosmic sword and sorcery, Flash Gordon, He-Man kind of vibes going. So it's really fun. I've always loved to infuse science fiction into my fantasy.
Okay. So let's do this, man. Let's talk about Stargazer Keep. So according to the blurb here, it says a cosmic sword and sorcery RPG zine series inspired by the music of Ronnie James Dio, channeled through the lens of Mork Borg, a Metroidvania inspired mega dungeon rises from the desert wastes into the astral void. Here marks the start of an epic adventure path powered by doom, distortion, and dungeon crawling. So that's pretty epic. I feel like there's a lot of stuff going on here. So hit us. Where did this all begin, John? It seems like you're the real mastermind for this particular project.
Oh, yeah.
So, decades ago, the first time I came across Dio, I think the first time I even knew who Dio was from Tenacious D. They had a song called Dio where they sing about how he's too old. He's got to pass the torch. He's too old to rock. I was like, who's this Dio? And then I listened to his first record, Holy Diver, which isn't really his first record. It was first with that project, with that group of musicians. It just clicked, and I was like, this is awesome, like fantasy, proto power metal, just a blast, so much fun. From there I started to learn more about, his history as a musician, and discovered his work with the band Rainbow, which is where the song Stargazer comes from. And Stargazer is like, it blew my mind when I first listened to it. I was like, this is so cool. It's a song about a wizard who builds this tower to the stars, and he wants to ascend into the heavens. And he finally gets to the top of the tower, and he's about to ascend. All of his followers are watching him, and then he falls to the ground. And everybody's like, what do we do now? What happened? And I always just envision like, what is the story there? There's it's just so evocative. There's way more than just what's in the song. It's always just set my imagination on fire. Always when I'm writing, I'm listening to Dio and I'm getting inspired by not just Stargazer, but all of, he's got so many big ideas that he stretches across all of his lyrics. It's all very, very just full of inspiration for me. So the idea of the tower from Stargazer, very easy for me to just drop into my early D&D campaigns and just say, there's this wizard tower. Here's the story behind it. It's just something that you come across, or something that you go into, or maybe they interact with the wizard or something like that over the years of DMing. Always kind of had an idea of like making a D&D supplement that included that. As I started to lose interest in D&D and gain interest in other RPGs, and also gain interest in the concept of campaigns set in a mega dungeon. Terry and I played in several mega dungeon campaigns together, and they were always the most fun. We did Barrow Maze with a friend of ours, and Terry ran Gradient Descent in Mothership, which was a blast. It just made me think, like, Stargazer Keep has to be a mega dungeon. It's a tower that ascends into the stars. It's got to be huge. It's got to be epic. It can't just be, you know, a little wizard tower that's on the edge of a lake or whatever. So when we first started talking about it, it was just Stargazer. The song Stargazer, let's use that as inspiration. The more we talked about it, though, the more I was like, there's so much more in Dio's music that we could pull into this. There's different concepts that he kind of stretches across different songs that kind of makes it feel like a unified mythology when you look at his entire body of work. And so that inspired the idea that everything, you know, from his work in Rainbow through Black Sabbath, through Dio, the band Dio, and then to his final collaboration with the Sabbath guys in Heaven and Hell, to just bring that all in and just find ways to tie it together and fill in the blanks where we need to, which we've done a lot of great world building with the wizard and his followers and you know, the setting that we've placed it in and everything like that. It really created a pretty vast setting out of it.
Interesting. So you say that it's Metroidvania inspired. Can you talk a little bit about, like, what does that mean to you and how does that kind of present in the context of the product?
So I've always been a fan of the Metroidvania style video games. I really like the exploration behind it, and I mean, inherently they are kind of like, you know, the original Metroid games, Castlevania games. They're mega dungeons. Symphony of the Night, Castlevania Symphony of the Night, it's a mega dungeon that you explore and you find secrets and you unlock shortcuts and find things that help you unlock different areas of the dungeon. And so when I was thinking about dungeon design and some of the dungeons that I've played in, I just found myself thinking that they didn't quite capture the essence of, you know, the abilities and not having access to something until you have a certain ability or a certain set of knowledge or tools. And that's kind of where we have been trying to implement those Metroidvania design philosophies.
I think, like, not in this particular part of the dungeon that we're doing for this Kickstarter, but a good example would be, like, you know, a blue door that you need a, you know, something blue to get through. And so you have to come back to this area when you find that thing. A lot of dungeons I find tend to be, you know, fairly linear in that, you know, you do this room and then that room and that room, and then you get to the end. And part of the idea with this mega dungeon is, one, it's serialized. So we're going to release components over time. So it gets, you know, bigger and bigger as it stretches out to the stars. But two is, you know, you might find something later in the dungeon that reveals some secret you didn't know at the beginning of the dungeon. And there is something kind of fascinating as a player. It's like, I missed that, you know, and it's like, oh, I can't believe all this time behind the statue was the thing I needed. And, you know, that adds a little bit of a dynamic that I think a lot of mega dungeons could tap into. And when we talked about, you know, some of the themes in Dio's work, like, you know, like rainbows, you know, the different colors and how that might translate in, like, a physical space, you know, the way that we could hide secrets and reveal them in the future, it really felt like the Metroidvania method was really going to give us that little bit extra to get people to want to, you know, go back to previous areas, rediscover, re-explore areas. Yeah, that's part of what I think is unique about this project.
Interesting. So so from what I understand, you've got the first three zines that are going to be coming out. Could you talk a little bit about like what's in the three different zines and then kind of what's coming after?
Good, yeah. So we've got three books, and they are Black, Red, and Orange. The Black book is going to contain all of the player-facing information. So it's the Voyager's handbook, and it's got all the character rules, the classes, the unique magic system that we have, which is verses. So you recite a verse, like song lyrics, and you can use that to do magic, equipment, and all those sorts of things. And then the Stargazer guidebook is the red book, and that's like the GM book. And in there, that contains some GM facing rules, extra lore that, you know, the GM would know, and a short introductory part of the mega dungeon. So it's the red floor. It's the bottom of the rainbow. It's the very first start. And then the third book is the first major segment, which is Raiders of the Machine God's Tomb. And that is going to be the largest segment where you'd interact with more of the factions, you'd find out more of the lore, and you can discover all these amazing secrets.
Wow, that's really cool. I like the idea of the like colored books and everything. So are you going to be like limited in the number of zines that you'll be able to do? Or are you basically going, listen, if there's a color that exists, that's going to be a level?
I don't have a roadmap. Yeah, I feel like we're not running out of ideas, but
no. We have a roadmap, you know, orange through violet, you know, the seven, you know, the color spectrum, main seven colors of the rainbow. But like we've already talked about silver, you know, we've got an extra book in there just kind of wedged in. And we're talking about supplementary material, like doing a monster manual, doing a book of magic items and extra spells. Just kind of filling out as much information or as much extra content as possible. And then even going back, you know, maybe in a couple of years, we go back to orange and we say, hey, these are the hidden rooms in orange that we just didn't fit in the first time. And, you know, you find the secret passageway in one of the walls that was obscured, and we have like a mini dungeon, you know, in that section of the tower. Because ultimately, we're talking about in our minds, the tower extends into the heavens, but like we're writing 20 to 30 rooms per section, so there's so much more room for stuff in there that we can go back to.
Yeah. And another thing that we really wanted to do is we wanted to make each zine self-contained so that you could run, you know, the green section of the tower as a standalone adventure. You know, you could kind of like cut and paste and put it in your campaign. Or there's this through line that takes you all the way into the stars. And there's things that, you know, connect between the dungeons. But, you know, for creative game masters that want to file the serial numbers off a little bit, you know, they could run it in any campaign and it would fit the narrative that they have there too.
I really get the sense when you're talking about this, it almost feels like the Dark Tower from like Stephen King, where, you know, it can fit into pretty much, you know, the multiverse, everything is connected through this tower kind of thing. So is the wizard alive? Do we know? Is he dead? Or is that a secret?
It's a poorly kept secret. I would say we present it in the setting as if it's a secret, but it's pretty obvious pretty quickly that he's no longer around. And his followers have kind of picked up where he's left his trail behind. So some of those followers are still alive. The idea is that it's like 1,000 years after the events of the song. So some of those followers are still alive. riffing off other Dio songs, there was a cataclysm. So the world is kind of slowly in decline. We're seeing really a lot of negative effects that building this tower and the ambitions of the wizard have wreaked upon the earth. A lot of it is understated, and left maybe to the players and GMs to draw the connections themselves. But the answers are in there. We've kind of sprinkled them in throughout. We've kind of done the Dark Souls thing where we put descriptions, little bits of lore in each magic item, so that the players can take these magic items to one of the NPCs, and then she'll spout off a little bit of story about the tower to them as they collect these items.
Wow, that's really cool. You talked about like music as spells. How does that work exactly? Because I'm assuming you can't use Dio's lyrics. So have you like written your own music, or like how does it, can you talk a little bit about that?
So we took inspiration for spells from different sets of lyrics, made it, you know, pretty obvious like where we're drawing those lyrics from. And then each spell has a verse that you can recite in order to cast the spell, and it's probably pretty obvious that it's inspired by Dio's songwriting, but it's something that we've written ourselves, kind of either our own take on part of a song, or maybe just expanding on some of the ideas of part of a song.
The hardest part was trying to get them to rhyme, you know, and like, you can't rhyme, you know, death with death, right? Like you gotta like, but, you know, so they're kind of like short couplets, you know, two lines or three lines. And another cool thing about the system is, you know, we're not gating magic behind a class. So anyone can recite a verse, you know, just like anyone can quote song lyrics. And we have all these unique classes. There's seven unique classes that we're including in the first book, the Black Book. And just like Morkborg, they've got special abilities. But if they pick up a verse sheet, you know, they could sing verses all throughout the campaign.
That's fascinating. So that kind of makes me question. So you talk about that you could either use the Morkborg rules or the standalone rules that I'm assuming you're developing. Talk a little bit about that. How come you've decided to like make your own rules with Morkborg, like, and how different are they from each other?
Well, we weren't always going to. I think as the project grew, this was just another aspect of it. I think originally we were just going to say this is a Morkborg adventure, and then. At a certain point, we added an ability score, which I think, you know, a lot of products that use, like Gradient Descent comes to mind, where there's an added mechanic. It's all mothership, but there's an added mechanic with the bends. And so we had that in mind, and we added the Stargaze ability and just said, okay, there's an extra ability. It's Morkborg, but there's an extra ability. But then we started talking about classes, and we started talking about all sorts of different mechanics, day and night cycles, and different stuff like that. It just kind of evolved and said, okay, well, we're making a hack at this point. This isn't just Morkborg anymore. It's a little bit different. And it kind of gave us, I think, a lot of freedom to open it up and try new things and just play around with the rule set. I mean, who knows where it'll go? You know, I've had some late night brainstorm thoughts where I've thought, you know, maybe at a certain point it becomes more of its own thing than a Morkborg hack. But that's, you know, we're early on.
And the good thing about Morkborg is, you know, it's kind of flexible around the edges, you know, so it's still very much compatible. Like you could run it, you know, as is with, you know, vanilla Morkborg, vanilla with chocolate sprinkles Morkborg. And it would run great. For me, the turning point was when, because we were leaning so heavy into this lore, we had all this world building and we've got all these characters and they appear at different stages. And the Stargaze ability was sort of a way to, you know, kind of like a lore check, you know, so like, okay, as you're more exposed to this, you have a way to, you know, roll to see if you know, like an insight check. Some systems don't have that. And it's always funny to me when the players, they want to do that, but they don't have the ability. And we thought, well, let's add that in. And then with some of the classes, suddenly it just became like, well, this should be like a core mechanic for this and that. And yeah, it's transcended being just a hack, but still compatible.
Right. Interesting. So when does this launch? Because right now we have access to a sign up page for the Kickstarter. When can we expect this to? Well, I guess when this episode comes out, it will have already come out. So,
yeah. So the Kickstarter campaign launches on Tuesday, August 26th, and it's going to run for 30 days until Thursday, September 25th. And we are definitely looking forward to having so many people buy this game because it's going to be such an epic journey. This is just the start. But, you know, early support would really help us be able to bring this creative vision to life because we've got a lot of really great ideas and we've got a lot of ground to cover as we make our way towards the cosmos.
Will there be stretch goals or is it just this is the three zines for now and... Once we're funded, great. If we get more after that, even better. What does it look like?
You know, I like to try to keep crowdfunding campaigns less complicated. If anyone's been a big Kickstarter fan, I'm sure you've seen the stretch goal death where, you know, a project is buried under the collective weight of all the unplanned stretch goals. So the core of the campaign really is to fund the three zines and get them into people's hands as quickly as possible. And then that'll let us really put effort into the next group. But I don't know, John, I wouldn't say no stretch goals, but we're not really planning on having a ton of them right out of the gate. I would maybe say that.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, we have so many ideas for the future of the product. You know, where we're going to go onwards from this part. We've talked about including some of those things as stretch goals, but at the moment we're really focused on finishing these three books. Honestly, and it's hard not to just keep writing and to focus on getting these ones out. I got so many ideas for Yellow, and I'm like, all right, what are we going to do next? Where are we going next? It's really important to focus on these and get them out the door. I think one of our goals is to have the project pretty much in its final stages, before the Kickstarter ends so that once the funding's complete, we start shipping and people get the books in their hands right away.
Yeah. And, you know, we've got a preview adventure that we've released. It's called Black Swampy Water. It's just like a little, like, you know, 4-page thing. You know, that's something that people would be able to get right now if they want to check it out. And then, yeah, it is really tempting to want to write more stuff. But, you know, we'll see if we get everything all finalized first and then maybe there's more we could do.
So. You're talking about trying to have it like out the door more or less after the Kickstarter is finished. What's the, in terms of like printing and stuff like that, are you only doing PDFs or are you going to have a hard copy available and how is that going to be available to supporters?
Yeah, there's a local printer that we use here in Calgary. They're called Little Rock Printing. They're actually not far from the parts of town that we're in. They do great work, and they've done a bunch of other Terry Hirt Games prints for us. Really important to support local businesses when you can. And I think we're fortunate that we've got a really high quality printer right here in town. People will have the chance to get print copies of the project. And our intent is to ship anywhere in the world. The digital will be available too. We've got that preview adventure that people will be able to get. And we actually did a test print recently of black to see how it looked for color. Yeah, there it is right there. Yeah.
Come on, John, don't be shy. Hold that sucker up.
Yeah, first test print. That was a couple weeks ago. It came in, and it looks great. I'm really happy with how it turned out. We got pretty decent quality paper, and
that's amazing.
That's pretty cool. So this is just one of three, though, and of course, test print. We got revisions to make on that too.
Right.
But it's evidence that we're close. We're close to the finish line, like I've said.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And honestly, you know, we went really art heavy with this project. We worked with some really fantastic artists, all original made art. And I shouldn't say all original. There's art from some dead people in there too. but the artists that we commissioned stuff from.
You didn't kill some of the artists, did you? It's going to be worth more now.
Yeah. Well, they work so hard. Sometimes they work themselves to death. But just the way it came out in the book, like, it just looks beautiful. The way John did the layout looks incredible. So yeah, I'm really excited to get this into people's hands.
Yeah, it looks fantastic. So I kind of, just to sort of wrap things up, I got just a few last questions here. As a Game Master focused podcast / YouTube channel, I always feel like I gotta ask the question, what kind of advice would you give to new and or veteran GMs? And I'll start with you, Terry. What would be your advice?
Oh man, you know what? John mentioned Blades in the Dark, and I've recently picked that game up again. And one of the things I love about it is it's very collaborative. Sometimes I think GMs feel they have to write a novel and act it out on stage with their players. But if there's anything that I've learned over the last few years of games is, you know, bring your players into that creation, let them create the story with you. It's so much more rewarding. You know, everyone's always got a better idea than you. You know, listen to those ideas and bring them into the game.
How about you, John?
Practice improv. I used to be the kind of GM that would over prep, just prep, spend hours and hours, and like Terry said, have a novel written and just go off that. And it never works. You always end up going off into left field and your players do whatever they want to do. And you end up, you know, making stuff up as you go anyway. So I'm not saying don't have an outline, don't have a path that you're trying to follow or tools that help keep you on track. But the more you practice improvising, and if you have, you know, players that are willing to kind of bounce that stuff off with, the better. But the more you do it and step out of your comfort zone, the better it'll be, and the easier it'll get to run games.
Nice. I like that advice. Both of those are very sound pieces of advice. Is there anything that I didn't cover about the Kickstarter or anything else that you guys wanted to say that I missed? No, John, Terry?
A couple things come to mind. The first is that we do plan on coming back with the next section pretty quickly off the tail end of this one. The goal is to kind of do this on kind of a 6-month release schedule.
Nice.
Yeah.
Will it be like one zine at a time type of deal, or will it be another like three zines at in one shot like this one is?
I feel like we're setting a precedent by doing three zines in the first campaign that it would, I wouldn't feel right doing just releasing one for the next one. So we're going to have something like we've talked about, having more character options, monster manual, tools that GMs can use to come up with their own adventures and encounters in the space that we're creating. Yeah, I think there'll be more than one, at least more than one in the follow up.
Yep. And I'd also say that, you know, we've got a pretty solid first draft of Yellow and Green, actually. Early play tests have led to some revisions, but that's one thing I love about this kind of art form is, you know, when you get it out at the table, sometimes it crystallizes certain bits. And actually, crystals are going to feature rather prominently in Yellow. But, this you'll have to wait for that campaign. But please back the first one.
Definitely. I'm actually kind of curious when we think about like mega dungeons and stuff, we think about these massive maps with like tons of rooms and stuff in it. But one of the things that like Mothership does, for instance, is it tends to be more of like a diagram flowcharty type of deal. Is that the model? Are you following a Mothership model more, or are you going for a more traditional dungeon map level style?
I think early in our development, we started with, truthfully, we'd just come off playing Gradient Descent when, you know, we really started this project in earnest. And the original design was kind of that wire chart or circuit board type layout. And we talked about it, and we actually decided to commission a map. So we worked with Elven Tower. They've done a lot of stuff for 5e products, and we got an isometric map from those folks. So the red book and the orange book both have isometric maps, and I think we're going to see how people respond to these and decide how we're going to do the maps in future books, because I think the physical landscape of the tower is going to change, so maybe the way we present it will change too. But we do have two beautiful isometric maps here.
The verticality is really a challenge when it comes to mapping. Yeah, we're it really is kind of a bit of an experiment to see, like, how well does this work? How much are people actually using the maps and versus, just drawing out their own.
So the other thing is that talking about the ability to go back and forth in a traditional mega dungeon with like levels, usually they say like whether you're going the higher you go or the lower you go, it gets more dangerous. Is that something that it feels like maybe you're throwing that out on its head kind of thing, where you're like, listen, man, it's a dungeon level. There is no level one. It's all danger all the time.
I mean, there's definitely all danger all the time. Because we wanted to keep the books kind of like you could pluck it and put it over here and run it as its own thing. And we do have a level advancement system that sort of relies on character death. So in order for the party to gain a level, without going into all the details, you know, there must be blood. And so, losing Jeez. Characters. Yeah, I know, right? It was John's idea. I love it. But so losing characters is kind of part of the fun for this game. And because of that, some areas are more deadly. But when you get to a certain part, like the green book will have sort of a recommended level range, and if people are higher or lower, that's okay too. And being able to revisit sections, if we add more content later, then, maybe there's something at the bottom of the dungeon that's super dangerous, but you just didn't have the thing to get past the door.
Interesting. Okay, nice. So I'm going to have links to your, obviously, to the Kickstarter itself, to your drive-through page, and to your website. Where can people reach you if they want to get in touch or, you know, say hi, send you cash, you know?
We definitely always accept cash in exchange for products. But the best way to get a hold of me is by email. It's terryhurtgames@gmail.com. I am on social media. Email is usually the best way to get a hold of me if, you know, you got a quick question or need a fast answer.
Best way to reach me is probably Blue Sky now. So that's rocketboot.bluesky.social. Yeah, I can be found on there, dropping Stargazer stuff or just random musings.
Nice. Well, this has been totally rad talking to you guys. This sounds like such an amazing and unique project. From the minute that I got your email and I saw this and I took a look at your Kickstarter page or your the promotional page, I was like, wow, this is definitely something special that you guys have like tapped into here. I'm like super excited to get my hands on the product. And I'm sure that you guys are going to fund and put out this and continue to put out, new levels. So thank you so much for like bringing this to my attention. Just not only that, but the fact that like now I've got access to these new mothership modules and everything like that. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is amazing. and just getting to connect with fellow Canadian content creators was another huge plus for me. I don't want to go into like the craziness of the world right now, but I don't think there's been a better time to be Canadian than there is now. Totally. So it's cool to see, products coming out and available tariff-free for us.
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
So,
well, honestly, thank you so much for having us on the show. We're really grateful for the opportunity and it's been amazing talking with you.
Thank you. You guys might regret it afterwards. You'd be like, I can't believe we went on the Dungeon Plunger. What was up? What were we thinking? He's called the Dungeon Plunger. The pleasure's been all mine.
Fantastic. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much, Jason.
Thank you so much.
All right, guys. Well, that's it for the show today, guys. Make sure you follow that link. Support Terry Herc and John. I didn't get your last name, John, but I will make sure to get it in the show notes so everybody knows who to credit. And elbows up. Plungers up. Well, listen, it started off with elbows up, and then later on I was like, plungers up. So that's sort of, but listen, we accept both plungers and elbows up in this union. So until next time, I will see you later.
That's all for this week, folks. Music and Stingers by Reed Reimer of Fable Factory Studio. Cover art by John McNally. And a special thanks to Edward Vallee, the voice of Hector.
Greetings, listener. It is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that linguineon's Jason. If you want to hear more interviews like this one, follow us and share this podcast with your friends, your family, your neighbors, random strangers, the people living in the wall, the troll that lives under the bridge, the guardian of the lost city, everyone! It means the world to us that you share our podcast and make our numbers bigger. Plungers up!
And remember, when you're plunging in the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt.